My name is Courtney Richardson. I'm Director of Education and Public Programs here at the museum. So I just want to welcome you all, welcome our panelists, and if any of you are new to the museum, I'm going to talk about it in a second, so bear with me. We are thrilled, as always, to be working with the Gloucester Writer Center. Again, I thank you all for coming, and I hope to see you this summer at some of our various programs and events. I really want to thank our members for their support, and I see some of you out there. And for those of you who aren't members, I want you to maybe consider becoming one. Among other things, membership supports our ability to care for the collections. So after Vincent Farini's death, we were given, his estate gave us his entire archive, including his library. It is in the process of being cataloged, so don't think you can rush right out of here after this to access it, but that's part of our collections, and our members help make that possible. Membership also makes our special exhibitions possible, and I don't know if you've had a chance to go up to the third floor and see Four Winds, the Arts and Letters of Rocky Neck in the 1950s. And that is a really fresh look at the art scene after 1950, and it's worth experiencing, and it's definitely representative of our ongoing efforts to keep bringing the art history up to the 21st century. Members also receive first notification and free admission to most of our events and programs, and some of our upcoming events include a lecture with Peter Anastas in July about coming of age in the East Gloucester art world in the 1950s, and also Amiel's presentation in August, and that's about his father, and it's called An Artist's Migrations. Most importantly, membership gets you in the door as often as you'd like, and to get to encourage you to become inspired by the art, history, and culture of Cape Ann, and that's what hopefully we'll be learning more about today. So I'll stop, but again, on behalf of the museum, thank you for coming, and I'd like to turn this over to Dorothy Shubo Nelson, who's worked tirelessly on this wonderful event. It's been a pleasure to work with her.
Welcome, everyone. Be sure that you let me know that you can hear me. Everybody, I want everyone to hear everything, okay? From everybody. Thank you for coming to help. To help inaugurate this panel, which we probably should have called a mini conference. That might have been better. But we are going to look at the aspects and impacts of Vincent Farini's work as a prodigious, innovative, and visionary writer for approximately 60 years. Many thanks, really, to the Cape Ann Museum, a valued jewel in our midst, for hosting this panel. It's so great to be here. It's such a beautiful place. And be sure to see this exhibit that's upstairs on the third floor. The spectacular Four Winds exhibit of Rocky Neck artists and writers from the 50s. It's striking to see Vincent Farini's original magazine, a quarterly of arts and letters, Four Winds from 1952, under glass. And some of his early Gloucester poems, as if they're engraved on the walls on the third floor. And we appreciate the enthusiasm and support for this group of writers, this panel, from the Gloucester Writers Center, especially Henry Farini, Annie Thomas, Susan Aroni, and Lisa Breen, and anticipate this evening's gala, the Poets Cabaret at Maritime Gloucester on Harbor Loop, as a great gathering of the creative spirit to celebrate Vincent Farini's 100th birthday. We're grateful also to Courtney Richardson from this museum, an enthusiastic, inventive, and wise associate. In 1972, I knocked on the door at 126 East Main Street. I was riding around Cape Ann on a secondhand three-wheel. A secondhand three-speed bike. Someone told me I needed to meet Vincent, and a conversation began and never ended, in person, on the phone, and in letters. You know, many of us have those letters. Hundreds of us have hundreds of letters. Just imagine that. We kept up with each other for 35 years. When I would visit, he would ask right off, "What's going on?" The typed letters kept coming, alive on the page. Each missive an anchor, speaking often about what's difficult and ineffable, but in the speaking, grabbing hold and forming something to prevent meandering, something that could matter from one to another. Not to respond to a letter from Vincent was a grievous offense, particularly if that letter came from a writer, as Vincent was, of course. Without conversation, we are separated, an unnatural state. Without study, research, stories, and communing, we are separated from the past unnaturally. And in that sense, we are separated from ourselves. Without readers and listeners and reviewers, the poet's work lies dormant on the shelf. We are now confronting some eternal questions. What matters to us now and in the future? What do we value? What merits value? I was thinking about Danusia Borchardt. What compelled this Gloucester writer and recognized translator of Polish literature to translate the poems of Cyprian Norwid, for example? Norwid, born in 1821, died in poverty in 1883 in a Polish hospice in Paris. Borchardt writes in her introduction to this book called Poems, "He was so original that scholars couldn't pigeonhole his work into any specific literary period." By the way, I want to say she's in Poland now at a conference for translators. She's sorry that she couldn't be here. But I interrupted the quote about Norwid. "He was poorly understood during his life and accused of being obscure and cerebral. His ideas were that of a man deeply distressed and disappointed in mankind, yet hopeful of its eventual redemption." In the poem Obscurity, Norwid confronts the critic who protests the obscurity of my speech. Quote, "It's faith you need. Ash and spark are not enough. Have you faith? Then watch. Watch it blaze." Many great poets have faith. Renowned poet Mahmoud Darwish, who was expelled from Palestine as a child with his family, a witness to atrocities and endless war, was able to write these words, "I want from love only the beginning. The pigeons flew over the sky's last ceiling. The pigeons flew and flew. A lot of wine will remain after us in the jars. And a bit of land is enough for us to meet and for peace to arrive. I will close with these three short stanzas from a longer poem from Vincent Farini's book, published by Igneous Press, A Tale of Psyche. Any day, any given day, is a boon for whatever it offers. Oath and blood have their own rhythms, meandering away, taking each thing as it never was, is more than a beginning. So you have your program, and we're going to follow the sequence. You can find out more about these spectacular writers and scholars in the program. And one change in the program is that after Peter Anastas, we will have David Rich, but all the rest of them will follow along. So let me introduce Peter Anastas, who probably... Am I right? Knew Vincent the longest of all of us. And they loved each other very much, gave a lot to each other.
Can you hear me? Okay. I remember vividly the first political meeting I attended in Gloucester with Vincent Farini. It was after Charles Olson's death, and Farini, who during the 1960s had quietly supported the older poets' battles against urban renewal, the razing of historic buildings, and the filling of pristine wetlands for used car lots, was beginning to go public with letters to the editor of the Gloucester Times. Vincent had not yet adopted his iconic black hat, while his curling gray hair was still kept largely under control. One night, during the mid-1970s, I picked him up at the frame shop, and we drove to City Hall to join the fishermen's wives and other groups who were protesting an attempt to expand the Blackburn Industrial Park through the construction of an extension road over the Babson watershed, which we argued would endanger the city's principal source of water and encroach even further on Docktown. "Now look," Vincent said as we entered the gradually filling auditorium, "let's separate. You sit on that side, I'll be over here. Everybody spread out. Tell your friends we can't be seen as a block. Our opponents shouldn't be able to figure out how many of us are here or who we are. By disappearing into the crowd, we can listen to what's being said on both sides of us. And when we get up to speak, we'll be getting up out of nowhere. That confuses people. They'll also believe we've packed the joint, which will make them think there are more of us than them. It will make the counselors anxious, too, if they think there are a lot more eyes on them than actually are." This was the first, but not the last, of my experience of Farini as a savvy activist and organizer. Over the years, he rose from the crowded City Hall to excoriate councilors who were poised to grant special permits for a shopping mall on the working waterfront, to allow luxury condos and a golf course in the West Gloucester Woods, or to rezone the waterfront for new housing while forcing fishermen and fish processing out. And always it was fishing Vincent supported, always fishing the lifeblood of the city, just as shoemaking had been the mainstay of his former hometown of Lynn. Looking back on those early experiences with Vincent in City Hall and reading closely the scores of letters Vincent wrote to the local newspaper against the background of the poet's political coming of age and growth in Lynn, first as a budding anarchist and later as a union organizer at the GE plant and member of the Communist Party, as revealed by David Rich's important research. It's become clearer to me how Vincent cut his political teeth in Lynn and how that experience, though muted during the worst years of the Cold War and the McCarthy anti-communist hysteria, informed his later life as the poet whom Lawrence Ferlinghetti would call the conscience of Gloucester. Herman Melville wrote that a whale ship had been his Yale College and his Harvard. For a child of the Italian-American working class like Vincent Farini, his only college had been the Lynn Public Library, where, unable to afford an education beyond high school, he and future novelist and historian Truman Nelson mapped out a four-year liberal arts curriculum for themselves and pursued it vigorously. Their graduate school, study groups, and writing for and publishing in a variety of political and cultural periodicals, but in the crucible of political action. In Vincent's Hermit of the Clouds, a book that takes its place along such seminal American documents as Kenneth Rexroth's An Autobiographical Novel and Edward Dahlberg's Because I Was Flesh, Farini recounts in brief but telling passages how he came to join the Communist Party, his involvement in organizing Lynn's first teachers' union, the formation of WPA workers' unions, party faction meetings and caucuses, the struggles between two factions of the electrical workers' union at GE, and the coming of McCarthyism that cast a pall on most progressive political thinking and political activity at the time. Eventually, Farini leaves what he calls the Church of Politics. But even after his liberation from the demands of organized political action from GE and Lynn, the factory is in a forgotten city, he writes after settling here. Even after that, Vincent brought with him invaluable political tools which he would employ in his new home, the fishing port of Gloucester. Reading Farini's letters to the editor, along with the poems included in his Gloucester epic, No Fish, one finds articulated and mirrored the same issues and concerns Farini struggled with in Lynn, including the right of free citizens to demand redress from wrongs, governmental or otherwise, to enjoy freedom of speech and expression, to fight expropriation of what was rightfully theirs, while battling the exploitation of their communities and common resources by those who had no stake in them. In May of 1984, he advocated for the protection of a neighborhood beach at Plum Cove. A beach is more than a beach. It is a way nature has of teaching us how to live when we mind its business, when we listen to her, Farini said. In December of 1988, Farini warns a city about to make another short-sighted mistake. It is the present that makes the future. But if we have no present, we have no future. And in countless letters and testimony, Farini continued to speak against what he called the wildfire greed that will destroy the spirit and originality of our city. At the core of Farini's activism is an ecology, both material and spiritual, that he had only begun to understand and elaborate in the streets and factories of Lynn, and which, through coming to Gloucester and immersing himself in the city's social, economic, and political life, as well as in its natural environment of land and ocean, nurtured both a new poetry in Farini and a more holistic vision of art and society. As Farini writes in his introduction to No Fish, the thrust of the whole work is in knowing fishes in men, women, and the sea. The pitch is that only when we connect with the interior fishes, our own histories, our very unconscious, are we discovering and extending life by the innate rules of the earth, and thereby saving the self, the family, the city, and the planet. Thanks.
Can you hear me? Yeah? Okay, so I can boast of having but one conversation with Vincent Farini, which occurred on the evening of April 27th, 2006. And having taken part in a poetry reading at the Sawyer Free Library with Vincent, Skylar Hoffman, Patrick Dowd, and some others, some of us reconvened at the White Rainbow, and I spied Vincent sitting at the bar. Summoning a little bit of courage, I approached him, interrupting a conversation he was having with a lady friend, and I ventured to tell Vincent that I admired his work, and that being able to read with him was a true pleasure. Vincent grabbed my right arm with a strength I had not anticipated, pulled me close to him, and in my ear, with his unforgettable voice, giving each word that deliberate meaning, he said, "I caught what you were. Very emotional, very intense living." So, in a most matter-of-fact way, right, devoid of any kind of malicious intent, Vincent had directed this penetrating gaze into me, summed me up, and used his words as a mirror so that I was confronted by my own interior image. Overwhelmed by his calm and incisive words, all I could do was back away and slip off into the Gloucester night. So my research into Vincent's life and work began only a couple months ago. So everything I'm saying is kind of preliminary. And I was asked to help Peter Anastas lead a two-part discussion group at the Gloucester Writers' Center, which is the site of Vincent Farini's former home. And so I used to do archaeology, and so my archaeologist's instincts were animated by when I realized that at the University of Connecticut, where many of Vincent's older letters are, there was this glaring erasure. The earliest letters, housed in Connecticut, date to 1949. That's a full 13 years after Vincent began publishing his poems in a range of literary magazines like Intermountain Review, Beaux-Arts Westminster, Man, Solidarity, and Quickening Seed. So there's nothing from the 1930s that survives. And almost nothing from the 1940s. In the 1940s, he had published a number of poetry collections inspired by his Lynn years and working at the GE plant in Lynn, including Injunction, Blood of the Tenement, Tidal Wave, and Plow in the Ruins, books which deserve full republication today. So having become intrigued by this erasure of Vincent's early archives, and having begun probing into Vincent's precarious life during the Cold War, I had to conclude, in concert with Peter Anastas and Amiel Alkali, that Vincent had in fact destroyed his own papers to protect himself and his friends and comrades, most likely around the year 1947, when, due to the sensational testimony of Boston-based FBI undercover man Herbert A. Philbrick, whose memoir, I Led Three Lives, became a bestseller and the basis of a popular TV show. Some of you may remember this TV show. An extraordinary degree of scrutiny and suspicion started to fall on Vincent's union, local at General Electric, and on the night school where he taught, the Samuel Adams School for Social Studies. So I guess these are the two things I want to hit in this talk, is the union politics and this really interesting night school. So to start with, the national union to which he belonged, the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers Union, or the UE, had taken on a much more progressive aspect after a reformer named Albert Fitzgerald ousted this longtime union boss named James Carey in 1941 in a national ballot. Fitzgerald, his home local, was Lynn Local 201, same as Vincent's. So there were these bitter campaigns of hazing, intimidation, and violence on the factory floor designed to terrorize Fitzgerald's progressive supporters out of the local. And Philbrick's accusation that communists had designed this coordinated plan to infiltrate Lynn Riverworks, GE plant, which subsists even today on defense contracts, you know, was one of the contributing factors leading to the UE being expelled from the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, in 1949. And then Vincent quits GE and this, you know, union in 1950. So furthermore, Senator Joseph McCarthy and his legal aide Roy Cohn come in person to Lynn, and in a televised and much-covered tribunal interrogated Vincent's former machinist co-workers. So the ultimate result of this designated attack on UE Local 201 was Fitzgerald's total loss, and the machinist workforce at GE, under immense pressure, left UE altogether, voting to go with James Carey's newly chartered IUE, so which was a union which existed on paper, for the express purpose of doing away with Fitzgerald. So that was Vincent at Lynn and at GE, which is one of the reasons why I think he destroyed his papers. Philbrick, McCarthy shows up in Lynn, and people are being televised and interrogated. So let's destroy this, let's protect myself, let's protect my friends. And the second thing, the Samuel Adams School for Social Studies, a little-known phenomenon, but it was a progressive night school located at 37 Province Street in Boston, right downtown. It taught creative writing workshops, which Vincent led on Friday evenings. It taught child psychology, modern art, painting, labor economics, and political economy. It hosted music acts like Paul Robeson and Pete Seeger, and staged independent film series showing films that are classics, like Forgotten Village, Girl Number 217, The Wave, and Native Land. But those involved with Vincent at the Samuel Adams School suffered extensive harassment, blacklisting, red-baiting. The Dutch mathematician, Dirk-Jan Stroik, singled out by FBI man Philbrick, was prevented from teaching. Harvard literature professor F.O. Matheson, a board member of this school, committed suicide by leaping from a Boston hotel window. And Mary Knowles, like even the secretary, you know, Mary Knowles, the secretary, was convicted of contempt of Congress, you know. So quite literally, the House Un-American Activities Committee went through the faculty list of the Samuel Adams School, hauling board members and faculty members before HUAC for interrogation. So again, another reason why I think that this big gap in Vincent's archive at Connecticut and even here, it's like there's nothing before 1949. I have to think he did this on purpose. So, you know, 1949 is when Vincent begins associating with Robert Creeley and Charles Olson and others of this burgeoning New American poetry movement, whose formative schoolhouse was not a social justice-oriented night school like Sam Adams, but an art college, you know, North Carolina, Black Mountain. So just to wrap up, I just want to say that, like, Vincent's literary associations predating his... I mean, he's known for knowing Charles Olson, but these other associations before Olson and things that he kept separate from Olson, I think are really fascinating. He knew Mike Gold, a major figure of this proletarian literary movement, who visited him in Gloucester and wrote the novel Jews Without Money. Gold was a close associate of the Russian poet Mayakovsky, and also Mayakovsky's mentor, David Burlik, a futurist writer and artist. And I think that the influence of Mayakovsky's poems and plays on Vincent has to be explored. That would be very fruitful terrain for a future scholarly examination. And also his affinity for Jack Conroy, and that's someone I would really stress as someone that who wrote the novel The Disinherited and was the center of a group called the Rebel Poets in the 1930s, as someone that would be great to research Vincent's association. So I think that's where we're going to stop now. Thank you.
I'm happy to introduce in a moment Kate Tarlow Morgan, who will be reading a presentation from Amiel Alcalay. We might take a few questions after that, have a little bit of discussion after that, and then some other impressions from Kate about her own work in the archives. But I just wanted to point out at this moment that Amiel had these two broadsheets made for this occasion, and everyone can take one of each as long as they last. And these, I don't know if you're planning to say a word about these or not, are part of the Lost and Found project that Amiel's involved with. So I want to introduce Kate Tarlow Morgan.
So let me see if this, Henry, this work. Hello, I'm Kate, and I am Amiel Alcalay right this moment. Before I become Amiel, I just want to say that he and I worked together making this broadside for the Lost and Found Project
that is sponsored and supported by the Center for Humanities at the City University of New York. And this is, do you hear me? Do you hear me? So, the broadside results that we have gotten are just 1% of the amount of material that is in the KBAN archives that, of course, Dave Rich just talked about. And Amiel and I have been going through them for about 8 months in order to put together a chapbook of some of his political writings. And there will be some other people who will be talking about that, too. I just, you know, just listening to these first two wonderful talks to precede other wonderful ones, I was reminded of a poem that my father taught me from Vachel Lindsay. He grew up in the Midwest. Factory windows are always broken. Factory windows are always broken. Factory windows are always broken. Somebody is always throwing bricks. So, from Amiel, sorry he can't be here. Dear Vincent, my first letter to Vincent was written in 1969 when I was 13. He had already taught me how to draw the vowels and emphasize the consonants of Jesus Christ, something that drove our Orthodox Jewish neighbors, the Margolis family, completely crazy. In 1975, a month after my 19th birthday, when I reported that I had gone through Ezra Pound's ABC of Reading, Vincent declared that I was summa cum laude right from this frame shop, so you'll know it's really authentic. We continued exchanging letters, news, books, until his last year. Throughout, Vincent paid attention. He told me that he was reading what he was reading and embraced the political content of my work, enthusiastically recommending it to other friends. I have always been aware of the profound value of this exchange, how much I learned from it, and how important it was to me. Vincent's embrace was encompassing. When Jack Kerouac died in 1969, and I responded with all the piss and vinegar that a teenager could muster, complaining about the injustice of so much of his work being out of print, Vincent not only suggested I write to Ginsberg, but provided me with his address. I wrote, and he responded. When Vincent lent me some copies of Diane de Prima's magazine, The Floating Bear, I asked him, where could I get more? Vincent told me to write her. I did, and she responded. Through these letters, I became part of a great continuum. When I first explored Vincent's archives in the Cape Ann Museum for the Lost and Found Project, I was humbled and overwhelmed by the range of correspondence Vincent carried out with so many different kinds of people. As new findings by David Rich, Peter Anastas, and others have come to light, my sense of Vincent's pivotal place in American culture has found new articulation, and I was able to start shaping a new history, one that began with Vincent's presence as I had known him, but it didn't end there. Going through Vincent's correspondence, I was intrigued by letters from people I have never heard of, with pointed political discussions and extended aesthetic critiques. One correspondence stood out not only for its longevity, but also for the range of references and experiences depicted. This is the correspondence of Meyer Mike Hecht, of which at this point, unfortunately, Vincent's side is missing. We don't know how they actually met, but might surmise that it took place in print by Hecht reading a poem of Vincent's in one of the little magazines of the 30s. An inventor and polymer chemist who held many important patents, Hecht was also a member of the Steelworkers Union, who wrote plays, sang in the opera, and had a theater column for the Radical Chicago Star, founded by Frank Marshall Davis, a major figure who bridged the new Negro Renaissance of the 30s with the Black Arts Movement of the 1960s. When we were finding this is Kate talking, the unfolding of this information was like a waterfall, and it was so exciting how every hour, every day, we would be finding some new connection really quite far away from this place, from Lynn and from Gloucester. So It was a rush. You all should have the broadside, Dear Vin, with an excerpt from one of Mike Hecht's letters, February 26, 1960. After an extensive elucidation of how unpropitious the social, cultural, political, and economic conditions are for starting a new magazine, and you will see that letter in the chapbook. He goes on to, you will have the last paragraphs, the last few paragraphs. And in these last few paragraphs, you will encounter Jack Conroy, author of the classic Disinherited, founder of the radical journal of the Anvil, and later with Nelson Algren, the new Anvil. We encounter the great poet Gwendolyn Brooks and her husband Henry Blakely, the poet of 63rd Street. Poet Margaret Danner Cunningham, who later moved to Detroit to participate in the Renaissance, and later part of the Broadside Press and Lotus Press. Artist and writer Margaret Taylor Goss Burroughs, founder of DuSable Museum, African American history, and one of the initiators of Southside Community Arts Center, very important place, key place in the African American movement. Paul Robeson was addressing the Negro community there at this party, but in Hecht's eyes, at least, he sees Robeson as a big wheel coming around late to battles that people like Hecht had already been waging for years. Others like the extraordinary talented poet named Steve Fox, perhaps lost to history. In this letter, these brief ending paragraphs, invisible lines of transmission reappear, and worlds never thought connected become conjoined. The huge political and cultural ambitions of people whose sensibility and aesthetic were formed in the cauldron of the 30s can be seen more starkly in the light of the Cold War and the post-war period. In short, a letter like this causes one's head to turn around and around like in a cartoon and seek a new place from which to reconsider the historical narratives we have been given. As Kate and I proceed on our Farini chapbook journey, featuring selections of some of his early poetry along with letters, we continue one of the founding principles of the Lost and Found Project, follow the person. In other words, put aside the assumptions and the schools and the categories and most histories as they have been written, and simply follow the person, see where and to whom they lead. Thank you. Okay, so I'm apologize for my reading. Amiel sent this to me last night, so I read it through once. I am very brief here. I also was an archaeologist and ended up in the archives. My first archive experience was in 1979, climbing to the top shelf of the municipal archives in New York City to look for the Dutch City Hall, which we then found in 1981. And my sense about my experience in the archives, of any archives, is that they definitely have an anatomical resonance to them. And if you're looking for something or someone and you spend that much time down there or in there, it really rubs off on you. And so looking at some of Farini's photographs,
Ha ha.
briefly, I hope I'm really not very good at this. What's happening is my eye is seeing the microphone, and then I'm... That's better. Okay. Can you hear me? It's so interesting. In a certain way, I know Vincent very well. It comes from the absolute substantial residue of his complete essence that still drifts along the streets and alley of this town. And in some ways, the fact that I was meant to learn of Vincent after he was gone puts me in a unique vantage point that I have no knowledge of him other than his essence, which permeates the Writer's Center and is projective in all senses of the word from the loving memories of his friends and co-conspirators. It's really an honor to you all that I know him. One such conspirator, Sarah Slifer Swift, who joined me on the proprioception panel at the Writers' Center last summer, quoted Vincent. He said, "The center and the circumference are the same." I'm going to say that again. "The center and the circumference are the same," which opens compelling territory not only for a dancer's explorations, but also for those of us trying to live the creative life. A couple of months ago, while working towards the dance that Sarah and I will present this evening in Vincent's honor, I stood next to her while she drew a letter addressed to her out of an old book, a Vincent book. This letter with a poem will be read tonight during the performance. "Yes, well, I feel this man. And even more so now, after spending so many hours in the Cape Ann archives with alkali sifting through Vincent's early letters and photographs. The search for the lost onions and bread, Farini's WPA project collection of life in the factories, everyone had been looking for it for months. I literally reached into the corner of the archive shelf and pulled out a manila folder. Is this it? I exclaimed. We had already ordered a Xerox of it from Pittsburgh, from Whitehead, but here it was in the archive, and I have been called Find It Girl. It also was really terrific being able to help Dave Rich sort through the precious mass of Farini's own library. I learned a great deal from just doing that. All of this, the song, knowing the man in the flesh, contributes to a very tangible surround sound kind of image of Farini that I have, and it is mine. A kind of etheric imprint that touches me and permeates my sensory motor loop. In fact, I feel especially today that Farini is here. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to introduce James Cook next, and I thought I would just read two sentences from a letter, July 7th, 2002, from Vincent. "Get Polis, a magazine, 5 years in coming forth by James Cook and his wife Amanda, sold on Olson. Bookstore has it. Or read my copy."
This is the one Vincent was in. Yeah, I'll be referring to it later. That was a great introduction. Thank you. It's great to... Those letters are amazing, and I've only just begun to go back through my letters from Vincent and my copies of my letters to Vincent, but more on that, I think, shows up here. In my first or second year as an English teacher at Gloucester High School, which puts us in about 2000 or 2001, Jim Fay, poet and English teacher at Worcester's Doherty Memorial High School, arranged for Vincent Farini to speak to his students. Farini couldn't make the long drive to Worcester, so Fay decided to pack up his students and cart them 80 miles to Gloucester. Worcester to Gloucester. It's worth pausing a moment to consider this movement. We can imagine Freeney's friend Charles Olson and Olson's family making this journey, albeit by a different path. This time of year, school's out, the coast beckons. Time to leave the industrial city behind. For the Doherty High students, the trip may not have promised quite as much as it did for young Charles, thinking of baseball, his dad's scabby golf, and the buzz of his mom's summer night chats. Nevertheless, I'm certain the students were happy enough to spend the day free from the monotonous quotidian rhythms of high school life, a chance to breathe without the strictures of the miscellaneous manacles forged by an increasingly standardized education. Worcester to Gloucester. Jim Cocola made this trek a week and a half ago to give a talk at the Writers' Center on the vernacular in Ferrini's poetry. He confided in me that the trip is always a little longer than planned and a little more arduous on the ground, so to speak, than in memory. Worcester to Gloucester. Dennis Corkery, then head of the English department at Gloucester High School, and one of Dave's teachers, right?
Yeah.
And my wife's teachers, my first boss here. Dennis Corkery played host to Ferrini, Fay, and Fay's students. Ferrini was to give his talk in the new lecture hall, but he was nonplussed to discover Fay's students filled only a fraction of the seats. Ferrini, having made his own journey from East Main Street to the school by the cut, wanted an audience. So Corkery went in search of warm bodies to fill the lecture hall and appease the displeased oracular raconteur. And this is where I come in. Corkery, who knew of my friendship with Ferrini, sheepishly entered my classroom mid-lesson, called me aside, and wondered if I might abandon my plans for the day to thicken the audience. So all 30 of us abandoned Beowulf or Hamlet or the Canterbury Tales or Lord of the Flies or Yeats, whatever it was we were studying in British literature that day, and we made the trip down the hall. Ferrini was a gangly giant that day with a mind on fire, prowling and pausing, moving back and forth across the linoleum floor, then lifting his head up to pick out a pair of eyes to peer or leer into. Those eyes, that look. He challenged students to demand a holistic education, wanted them to march down to the principal's office. Challenged them not to accept any shit, his word, to not accept anything that didn't enact a connection between body, mind, and soul, between self, others, and place. At times, he spoke directly. Other times, with extended metaphors familiar in his poetry, gardens, flowers, ships, fish. Other times, with high abstractions, the cosmos, holiness, wholeness, embodiment, essence, wisdom, being. References to dance yielded to references to sex, causing more than a couple students to blush and then gaze around furtively to see if anyone saw them blush. Debriefing after the visit, I discovered the students found him to be inscrutably provocative, precariously unfettered, and alluringly unorthodox. Students expressed more than a little ambivalence and struggled to explain what they felt. They were resistant, skeptical, but not dismissive. They knew they had encountered something real, something with integrity, something with force behind it and within it, something like a gathering storm glimpsed off the coast. They weren't sure how to make sense of what Ferrini had told them, and they weren't even sure whether it was worth making sense of what he had said. I invited Ferrini back a couple more times. During the subsequent visits, we used a more intimate space, a circle of desks in the library. During these chats, the subject matter also turned more intimate. His themes were self-knowledge, self-discovery, and self-acceptance. To illustrate his point, he talked about standing naked in front of a mirror and facing oneself, feeling one's own skin, one's own fleshiness, one's own boniness. Some students, of course, squirmed a bit at this. Others leaned in, not able to take their eyes off this octogenarian, nonagenarian, who spoke with intensity, freedom, and provocation. It's important now to pause again. I have to admit, at the time, I wasn't able to make much use of Farini's appearances in my classroom. I wasn't really able to integrate them yet, to follow up on them, to place them into the core of what we were up to. Not to say I didn't try. I'd follow up with a lesson asking students to write down some of what they remembered from his visit and to reflect upon its relevance to their own sense of being. Some good came of this, moments during which we were able to lift momentarily away from an inert curriculum, a moment in which the classroom was a kind of song. The teachers out there will know what I'm talking about. That said, I was so gummed up with my own wrestling match with institutional work that I couldn't, as I said earlier, integrate Farini and what he had said into my classes. I was trying to reconcile my own sense of language and life, my sense of what young people need, my feelings of inadequacy in the face of bureaucratic exigencies, my sadness about the culture at large. I was trying to reconcile all of this with my work in the belly of a beast, in the boiler room of an omnivorous educational factory. Beyond all that, my relationship with Vincent, particularly as a writer and editor, was sometimes difficult. It's important not to forget this, because this is the other side of great passions, the other side of pushing and agitating for a better world. He could be demanding and overbearing. He cared deeply about the integration of writing and life. He was deeply skeptical of literary pretensions, of how too great an interest in language itself, in poetic form itself, could lead one astray, could lure a seeking young person away from a more holistic vision of writing, thinking, and living. He was right to be leery of all this, but that didn't make his admonitions any easier to deal with. Here's a manifesto he published in the first issue of my Lit Mag Polis that sums up the instruction he wanted to pass along to me. A manifesto. Can the poets light a torch of ecumenical arts into the millennium? For the transfiguration and transformation of a culture that is wholesome, that nourishes the body and mind of the individual, can the arts face this responsibility to society? Shelley, long time ago, said that the poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. It is high time to act on this fact. Can they be the archangels of our frustrated? Can they be the archangels our frustrated culture is waiting for, and realizing itself by bursting the bonds of all forms of restrictions from the cradle to the grave and after? Anything less is more of the same routine. My belief is that Gloucester is on the way to becoming the agent and the example. This year, nearly two decades after I first met Vincent, I've returned to his work. I've engaged with his presence and his influence. He is, for me, more present now than in the mid and late 90s when I saw him several times a week. And I've just begun thinking about the implications of his work for my teaching practice. It is this reflection that led me to accept the offer of participating on this panel and led me to dredge up my memories of Vincent at Gloucester High School. Here, finally, is my most abiding memory. During the last of Vincent's visits, he proposed a movement class for Gloucester High School. With clarity and detail rare during these visits, he described students gathering in the morning to dance in the boiler room beneath the school. They would lead the class themselves. It would be a way of waking up, of awakening the body to the work of the mind. He explained how such a class could change the school culture, could change students' lives. Dancing in the boiler room. That's the image that stays with me. That's the image I take as a challenge. That's the image I've carried forward with me and that I would like to leave with you. Thanks.
My first book had not been published yet, and meeting Vincent was, a force of nature, really. And we had our period of lover closeness, but we also had a lifelong friendship.
sometimes hard and sometimes wonderfully freeing. So I think that this serious play with words, working with children at the time, I was in the pilot program here in Massachusetts, and I see like Mark and Mary over there also were in that program. That, you know, in some ways really did communicate with Vincent, this working with children, and so many of the principles that I used with the kids, I also... you know, over at Leslie, we were starting this new program that was so interesting with the expressive arts and the expressive movement in this country, in the United States. And that was under the direction of Sean McNiff, who was also a very close friend of Vincent's. And one of the things that was so prevalent was the idea that all of the art forms inform each other. You know, like making poems on pieces of drawing paper with colors and leading into movement. And I, at that time, was doing a master's degree through Goddard with sound and movement and rhythm and pulse and language and poetry. And, of course, I was so interested to hear about Vincent's wanting to dance in the boiler room. Because so much, and the students, because so much of that time was trying to bring the arts together in many different ways to work with the healthy side of people. Certainly in the expressive arts, that was so much at the core. And now, and also with the children, you know. And there were some things that we just let go of at that time, that you didn't have to write nice poems, and you didn't always have to write poems about springtime, that you could write about all your feelings, and some of those feelings could be very unruly. And also just this whole thing that Vincent's, it seems like his intent at this time of his life was really to in himself and with the people, you know, in his realm of influence to try to heal the major splits and the mind, body, soul, I think that someone mentioned, you know, was so much part of that. And, of course, the oppression that comes, you know, from the workers and the bosses and, you know, and then, of course, it was the Vietnam. When I met Vincent, it was 1977, and the Vietnam War was supposedly over, but we were all reeling from all the wounds from that. And Vincent had so much history with that. I was born in 1938, and Vincent told me, you know, I was born in the great hurricane of 1938, and Vincent always told me, oh, 1938, that's when I flung myself into the ocean and, you know, swam towards the most beautiful woman who was underwater. Vincent was, you know... He was still in love with women, not just one particular woman at that time in his life, but really, you know, Vincent loved women. And as I go back, you know, through my many letters from Vincent and poems and everything, I realize also that as he was also so engaged with you know, with the movements of liberation, and the feminist movement was very important to Vincent. And he was reading, you know, lots of the major women writers, like I'll just mention a few. One that really interested him was June Singer, who wrote a book called Androgyny, and then Shulamith Firestone, who wrote another wonderful book. I've forgotten the name of it. And Germaine Greer, do you know that it was... Yes, exactly. Thank you. And then Germaine Greer, and he loved Gertrude Stein, and this was so. And so many of our letters were really about this, you know, and feeling, you know, that the relationships between men and women also, you know, were part of a movement towards a freer realm. So he was a harsh and also a very beloved teacher for me in so many ways. And sometimes we'd have terrible fights, and Vincent was used to it because he was always into the, you know, attacking and, you know, counterattacking and fighting and everything. I wasn't so used to it. You know, for me it was difficult. It was a hard learning. I didn't always feel so good about it. And then another thing about Vincent was in relationships with people was, and especially with women I'm talking about now, was this lightly tightly, you know, like always keep that correspondence, always keep the communication open, you know, but also have the freedom, you know, so lightly, tightly, but keep it together, always keep it together. And I think that was one thing that was so characteristic of Vincent was also holding the paradox. You know, he learned that from people like Keats and Shelley, especially Keats, you know, with the negative capability, the whole idea of holding the paradox, the lightly, tightly, the man, the woman. And he believed, you know, that there was a man and a woman inside each man and woman. That was one of his big things. And I had a poem at that time that went like this, started like this. There is a man inside me as terrible as myself. Sometimes at night he scratches at my funny bone and rubs, whispers hot music. I used to see him waving in the tall field grass behind my house. He followed me to the city. I found him raking litter in an unspecified spot. He beckoned me back to his place and laid me on a wood-sleek table. With a lick of a cat, I pounced and poured him down like an oyster. My eyes grew round and blissful. There is a man inside me as terrible as myself. So that's... Thank you. Do I have a few more minutes? Am I over? Is my 10 minutes? Okay, I have a very short. Okay, so harsh instructor. Well, then I just want to read a few little things from Vincent. Now, when I first met Vincent, I was a single mom, and I had a daughter, Jenny. I still have her, Jennifer now. And it was her 11th birthday, and this was the letter that Vincent sent to my daughter, Jennifer. He loved children, you know. Dear little Jenny, here is a fin, the tooth fairy lifted off Santa's bag. She brushed his nostrils with it, but he couldn't see because the ink was not dry. But still, in Uncle Sammy's belly in Fort Knox, quite a trick fooling Santa. Someday the little people are going to take Christ away from the adult world, and then we will see if they miss him. And that's what I have been praying for. If they do, Christ will live every day, and the adults will never grow old and die because we will all be in fairyland. Love to you and Elisabetta Venanziano. So thank you.
From me too, Elizabeth. I just wanted to mention briefly that No Smoke, which was published originally in the 40s, if you read that carefully, he had those kind of progressive feelings about women. All the poems that have to do with women are very empathetic. Heartfelt, empathetic poems in No Smoke, if I remember correctly, right? Kim? In the same letter, get the current number 39 issue of House Organ. Kenneth Warren, poet editor on Ralph Maud's Selected Letters of Olson, fourth and last section, page 39 or something. Thank you.
What I'd like to do today is lay out some of the ideological tensions that we can find in Vincent's work, and I hope that you'll be able to see how the great archaeological dig that Dave and Peter's work, how that bears down on Vincent's reading and discovery of C.G. Jung. So this tension between Marxism and Jungian psychology is what I want to kind of dilate today for you in Vincent's work. After the U.S.-Soviet alliance of 1941 to 45 shifted to Cold War rivalry, reactionary political pressure over communist infiltration of American life blasted a hole in Vincent Farini's livelihood as a benchhand at the General Electric factory in Lynn, Massachusetts. Scarred by the anti-communist purge of the Truman and Eisenhower years, Farini gave way in poetry to mystical perforations of factory logic and working class experience. With Infinite People, published in 1950, vague metaphysical expression began washing over industrial strength sense thinking about details. Turning generic was a specific outlook bound in historical time to the Marxist ideology that had been shaping his radical political agency since the economic crisis of the 1930s. Now shadowing his poetry were archaic emotions, invisible forces patently evoked from the aggressive right-wing political assault upon radical labor solidarity that had stood in his life for history, progress, and reason. As political repression moved him closer to the imperatives of spirit, his vocabulary turned more transparent. During a historical moment when the official enemies of the United States were the godless ones, Farini felt into the infinite, revisioning the people symbolically within a sacred rather than secular story. Incorporating the secret sayings of Jesus from the Gospel of Thomas, he declared in folk inscription, "I pass by day and night. No one has seen me. If you ever want to find me and know me, leave behind yourself and enter the caves of other people, where you will find me, who is yourself." Gnostic lyricism was his way of coping with concrete pressure. The idea that the anti-communist crusade was pushing him into hiding surfaced in the reception within The Hiding One, the title of a collection published in 1973, which opens again with Folk Song, the poem already published as Folk Inscription in The Infinite People. In The House of Time, published in 1953, the language of the opening poem is resonant with Farini's departure from the collective concerns of the factory. So listen to this in this context. "Where I once was, the shadow lay behind me. Now I am completely immersed in the shadow. My left eye is absent, and one half my body, from the head to my feet, is no longer with me." What such somber language suggests is the wipeout of his union, the communist-led United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America, by the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Traumatic encounter with America's red-baiting shadow greased the slide for Farini's skid into the symbolic surplus that was accruing to C.G. Jung's analytical psychology, largely through powerful connections to Howard Fowler McCormick, son of the Reaper inventor Cyrus McCormick, CEO of International Harvester Company, husband to Edith Rockefeller, and inspiration for Citizen Kane, with Paul Mellon, the son of the financier and industrialist Andrew W. Mellon, and with Alan Dulles, the private Wall Street lawyer whose appointments included director of the Council of Foreign Relations, mission chief of the Office of Strategic Services, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and member of the Warren Commission. As a matter of ideology, Jung's calibration of the tension between the individual and the collective in the modern age accentuated hostility towards state-based social programs while living alongside his highly successful cultivation of wealthy capitalist benefactors and private foundations. Like Charles Olson,
Ferrini could not finally escape the ideological pressures of American Cold War cultural policy that promoted Jung's analytical psychology and archetypal self-development conceits. Writing against the materialist bias of modern man, Jung counseled a return to religious sensibility, a careful cultivation of a new totality figure he termed the self, and a scrupulous relation with a God image that could induce the ego to stand down momentarily in order that the whole personality might become vitalized by an afflux from unconscious contents. However, collectivism, in Jung's view, indicated a dangerous regression to the unconscious. Such regression was evident, according to Jung, in the five-rayed star of Soviet communism, as well as in the black left-turning swastika of National Socialism. The theme of evil amidst the Soviets opened from the absence, said Jung, of spiritual symbolism. I'm not going to go into all of Jung's details, but what I want to lay out for you is that Jung had a profound antipathy to collectivism, and especially Soviet collectivism. And his relationship with Fowler McCormick in The Undiscovered Self framed his dislike for statist solutions in terms of spiritual struggle against mass-mindedness. So I want you to think about Vincent in terms of his experience as a labor organizer, as a member of the Communist Party, experiencing the dissemination of Jungian psychology in the late 40s and 50s through the force of capitalist benefactors, and understanding that that ideological tension between Marxism and Jungianism is really at the core of this spirit, material, dialectic in Vincent's thinking. If you go to the Cape Ann Museum and look at his library, you will see that from the beginning he's had the collected editions of Jung, Francis Wick, The Inner World of the Child was absolutely a crucial book for Vincent in kind of understanding his relationship to the divine child. But if you want to look at his sources, there's a fair amount of that material on hand in the library. But invariably, Jung's ideology of anti-statism, self-realization, and expansion of the individual psychic attitude became, through the support of McCormick, Mellon, and Dulles, an important asset to the Anglo-American imperial project that was emerging after World War II to confront godless communism. Notwithstanding the archetype of the unknowable wholeness that he termed the self, Jung's ideology relegated political economy to the shadow. Okay? What Ferrini does in reading Jung, Ferrini never relegates political economy to the shadow, despite his appropriation of various Jungian concepts. Okay? That's an innovation. That's a kind of wild man innovation that you'll see in Vincent's work. Perhaps the most fascinating aspect in Jung's interpretation of modern-day collectivism and materialism is the astrological one, through which the meaningful turning points in history are read symbolically in accordance with the precession of the equinox. The ideological conflict between dogmatic Christianity and atheistic materialism, Jung believed, was symbolically encoded within the age of Pisces, the age of the fishes. Within the coming Aquarian age were disruptive pneumatic potentials that would pattern consciousness differently. From the symbolic language of the heavens, Jung regarded Bolshevism, fascism, National Socialism, and even the New Deal as the final blowout of deficient one-sided egos masked regressively through material dependence upon state power. After amplifying the meaning of materialism and collectivism in relation to the waning days of Pisces, Jung went on to say in Nietzsche's Zarathustra, quote, Aquarius being a wind sign is, of course, a pneumatic sign, a sign of spiritual movement, of atmospheres and atmospheric disturbances. That celestial shift from fishes to waterman, outlined in Jung's writing, is foundational to Ferrini's conception of the epistemic, pneumatic, and revolutionary potentials that would emerge from the rhythms of time and eventually shape the fishing village of Gloucester. After moving from Lynn to Gloucester in 1948, Ferrini withdrew from the external world of the machine. He attuned himself to the inner world of living religious impulse, which Jung attempted to locate within an irrational domain he termed the collective unconscious. Once no longer bound to a labor union, Farini could recalibrate through Jung's psychology of the self, a relation to the collective, seeing there an objective container for the now sacred political agency of the poet, whose intent is to transform power relations through the language of love. In a primordial safe house, Farini could profess divinity. This house is holier than a temple. It is where I live and have my being. The foundation of this house was a shared possession of ideology, however. Jung pointed the way inside to a temple of the self. The anti-communist crusade called forth a spiritual reflex. Thus, Farini's spiritual movement in Gloucester can be read within the Gnostic momentum of the wind sign of Aquarius, as well as within the implications of the symbolic imagination and unconscious psyche that Jung espoused with respect to Pisces. In An Invitation to Clans, the editorial collective of Four Winds spoke transparently through such Jungian interests as symbols, the invisible life force, and the four corners. So think about Four Winds in terms of this Aquarian pneumatics that I'm trying to indicate here as part of the zeitgeist. By 1950, Farini had become an artisan, a maker of picture frames. With a moral self-reliance commensurate with a Jungian-inspired journey, he made a living by his own means. The ocean was now his supply chain. Farini. In Gloucester, the pitch of my verse changed from the rage of helplessness and economic anxieties to the vertical launching pads and the epic of fishing, Farini explained in an autobiographic account written in 1996. The vertical launching pads indicate a change in Farini's orientation. Horizontal and vertical lines are now crossed. Mystical ascent becomes the counterpoint to historical journey. In Gloucester, medieval conversion is possible. At the center of Farini's conversion is Jung's polar notion that the self appears as a play of light and shadow, although conceived as a totality and unity in which the opposites are united. Square Root of In, a book published in 1957, asserts along Jungian lines the alchemical, mythological, psychological, and spiritual supports for the self that would carry Farini all the way through to the Pleroma. In Square Root of In, Jungian language is multiplied into alchemies, intuitions, and opposites, so revealing Farini's self-concern. The shift from factory to self entails the reach beyond time, a grab for the extras of myth, Farini, grabbing more than choice and deed, times conquered, the myth sent aboard, indwells, for the sake of survival, painful labor history is put under a shadowy mythological dimension. Farini's feeling-drenched radicalism required spiritual sheathing. Consequently, he wagered upon a god image that could protect him from both Maximus and the dissonance of godless communism. After reading letter 5 of the Maximus poems, he registered the imprint of an emotionally loaded and eternally present god image, the face of Jesus Christ on the cross. In the grip of the Christ archetype, he found his hand, quote, operating by itself. The result was a painted image he called Self-Portrait of Jesus Christ, which later became the cover of the Magdalene Silences. Needless to say, the trickster shadowed Christ in Farini's unsuccessful effort to shake the Vatican's money tree, as he playfully reports in Hermit of the Clouds. The forge of creation expels me and the Self-Portrait of Christ. I write the Vatican what I have and will part with it for $1 million. Enclosing the colored photograph. The answer on official stationery that they cannot afford it. But they hold on to the colored photograph of him. I tried the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, and they reply, it looks authentic, but we don't have that money. How I'd love to use that kind of money, but it would be a drop in a bucket for my Monte Alban, but the water would never be the same. When Charles beholds it, I see a comet go scratching through his brain. I hear you. Clever. Farini loved to imagine his life, including his polar relation with Olson, in the unity of opposites. Especially appealing was Jung's recognition of enantiodromia, a psychic process wherein the unconscious opposite emerges over time from a one-sided tendency in conscious life. Over time, Farini's self-identification with the concrete reality of industrial labor could no longer contain the unconscious energies of his personality, which needed to break through the materialist bias of Marxist ideology and connect him with its opposite, the symbolic order of Jung's archetypal spectrum. As ideology ran its course in his life, the polarity between Marxism and Jungian psychology activated a third possibility, the poem, which is another kind of union, a synthesis that unifies the opposites without yes and no. In the model of Jung's topology, Ferini's psyche was now supercharged by the function of intuition, which perceives through the unconscious and is not dependent upon concrete reality. Intuition gives outlook and insight. It reveals the garden of magical possibilities as if they were real, says Jung in The Psychology of Transcendence. Whereas the sensing function had oriented Ferini to the concrete order of the factory grindstone, the intuitive function was now compelling him to participate more fully in the universal substrate that embraces both inner and outer relationships. Magic is the way that the left hemisphere sees power over which it has no control, announces Ian McGilchrist in The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World, a book which argues that the two hemispheres of the brain, while cooperating with human interaction with the environment, generate different patterns of agency, awareness, perception, style, and worldview. In explaining the evolution of Western culture through the structure of the brain, McGilchrist says there is evidence of left hemisphere dominance for local, narrowly focused, and right hemisphere dominance for broad, global, flexible attention. His sweeping synthesis of brain science sheds further light on the hemispherical conflict and resolved dialectically in a creative process that unifies the opposites. Throughout his writing, Ferini referred variously to the participation mystique, a term that Jung derived from the philosopher Lucien Levi-Brule. At bottom, Jung emphasized that participation mystique was a dangerous, raw, unreflective level of consciousness that lacks differentiating capacity required for ethical judgment. And those accounts that we heard of his classroom experience speaks to his effort to enact this kind of raw, dangerous participation mystique. Vincent loved the idea of participation mystique. Now, the other point I would like to say about participation mystique is that Ferini was not stopped by Jung's warning that it is a psychopathological phenomenon. Ferini would claim the relation between unconscious identity and mystique as the emotional ground of his poetry. From reading Jung, Ferini grasped that its collective embrace of conscious and unconscious, the self, and this is Jung, continuously creates that ubiquitous participation mystique, which is the unity of the many, the one man in all men. Now think about that line, not only in relationship to Ferini, but also in relationship to Jung, because they were to Olson, because they were both mining aspects and approaching the self through different typological agencies, through different egoic structures, hammering in, digging into that unconscious realm and coming up with something different on the basis of their own egoic functioning. Preamble to Divinity carries deep resonances within participation mystique, especially Jung's notion that primal personality is projected onto an object which thereby becomes supercharged with unconscious contents. Okay? Think about Ferini, okay, and wanting to generate that supercharge, right? That numinous supercharge to the objects within your city, the relics that he was looking to generate. Through language, Ferini urges participation in the unconscious as the wellspring of divinity, asking rhetorically, what's the poet's medium? Language. What's language for? Participation, to deliver the emotional mind. Reflected in participation is the divine child, the archetype which is essential to both participation mystique and the imagination of divinity. In order for language to become supercharged, says Ferini, the poet must, quote, catch the unconscious and become the infant already there, end quote. Wet with religious feeling and intuitive intimacy, the divine child connects the poet to the language nested in the anima mundi. Knowing firsthand from Olson's projective verse about how unconscious contents are projected and perceived in others, Ferrini sought in Participation Mystique the source for such primal activation. In opening the field of Participation Mystique to claims by the ego, he attempted to unify political agency, social conscience, and unconscious personality within what he calls the process of divine being. Quote, "I keep my eye and my heart and my mind on the process of divine being. Being divine, my primal sensations, the essence of the poems, of participation in the mystique," he wrote in the Pleroma. From a radically unorthodox reading of Jung's analytical psychology, Ferrini commandeered a lexicon through which the red memory of party dogma, shop-level torture, and shattered comradeship could be transformed into its opposite, the community of self, as he would eventually put it in the title of Book 4 and 5 of No Fish. For Ferrini, political agency and Participation Mystique must converge around social conscience at City Hall. Otherwise, quote, "the art of social dialectics isn't here. It's in the marketplace of cash." Without Participation Mystique, says Ferrini, City Hall will, quote, "flunk the know-how, the unknown, and the knowing, dictating by decree or fragments thereof." In identifying only with the marketplace of cash, City Hall is merely, quote, "a brain bank of deficient Participation Mystique, unequal to the whole city and the risk of a free mind in an angel body in a choral community," end quote. By injecting social conscience into Jung's shadow-filled collectivism, Ferrini managed to enliven the imagination of the self with a communal ethic of care. Ferrini harnessed class-based knowledge of capitalism and its deadly effects to a symbolico-mythological interpretation of reality. He knew his ticket was punched by financial capitalism and that ours was sure to follow. Ferrini, "Reagan and deregulation is the birth of the oldest disease. The heart and balls of the nation have been infected with a virus from colors, the numbers on the do-re-mi, the music of reaffirmation. Today's so-called lost generation, especially, will find in Ferrini's life and work present a compelling reality check to the empowerment fantasies of artisanship, entrepreneurship, and fun employment that a cheesy 21st century social contract is currently offering them. The political agency and Participation Mystique within his life and work urge all of us to activate through material struggle in the community the divine, ethical, and imaginary remedies that may restore the heart and balls of the nation before it's too late.
We have two more people on to present today, and Peter Kidd, publisher of Igneous Press, published a number of Vincent's terrific books, and also Fred Whitehead is here from Kansas City. Kansas. Where is he? There he is. And it's going to show some slides from a cultural conference and that are pretty terrific that Vincent went to in Kansas. So I'll introduce Peter Kidd, and afterwards we'll have a reception. But even before, I really want us to start talking to these people. Okay, so here's Peter Kidd.
Hello, everybody. Hey, peddler. Yo. And here's one of my favorite people in the world, Carol Weston, the love child of Emily Dickinson and a Native American. She has more off-the-cuff notes on the Holy Grail that I did 20 years ago than any person on the planet. On purpose, I mean, I felt like I was being placed into a box by having to do an abstract. So I purposely don't have a script because Vincent and I come from an old school and we think spontaneity is a big part of it. I could do an hour on the indweller, but we won't because we're trying to make some history. And so I'm going to probably go pretty quickly because I got a lot. Let's talk about how did I meet Vincent Farini? I think it was about 72, Boston Center for the Arts. Sort of this basin with a stage down below, and this little bitty man with hair billowing out everywhere and this big black hat comes walking out with about 3 inches of manuscripts and poems and so forth, and he walks out and he looks around, he looks up, he looks right, he looks left, and he slams it down on the table and he says, "I got enough material here to blow the roof off this building." So right off, I knew this was going to be good. And after the reading, we met, and he gave me his address, and he said, "Write to me. We'll write." I think I've got a couple hundred of letters between him, he and myself here, and his letters are at Kent State, and we're going to try to round them up out there for scholars in the Midwest. My first trip to Gloucester, I called him up, and I got the, "Hello?" Like, what the hell lies on the other end of this line? He's ready for anything. So we make arrangements, and I come down and knock on the door. And he comes to the door, and we give each other a big hug. He brings me in, sits me down on his couch, and all the while, he's got reel-to-reel going. And about 15 minutes after I'm there, he says, "You know who that is?" I said, "No." He says, "That's Charles Olson." And I said, "Who the fuck is Charles Olson?" At which he fell on the floor laughing. I came to him early on. I had taken Lady Carolyn, Robert Lowell's wife, in my taxi cab to their house in Cambridge and north of Harvard Square. I can give you the address if you want to meet me on the side. I went back with some of my poems, and I knocked on the door, and Lowell came to the door, but he wouldn't answer it. So I dumped him in through the letter thing while he stood there. So I told Vinny about it, and he says to me, "He denied your existence. Therefore, he denied his own." Which leads to the next piece of information. Vincent, long before networking wormed its way into the lexicon, was the ultimate matchmaker. I mean, I met through Vincent Farini. I've met Rich Blevins, who did the Olson Creeley correspondence after Butterick died. Peter Laska, who I've been in cahoots with for 30 years. Elizabeth McKim, Sid Corman, who we corresponded. He sent me Origin until I told him to go to hell. Ken Warren, I met through him. Joe Torra. I mean, an incredibly broad constellation of diverse poets. And he was doing this back in the 70s. He was hooking this one up with this one, with this one, with this. And it was an incredible, incredible, larger constellation that assembled around what he was doing. And the fact that he was so accessible to us all as young poets really was something we had never seen. And it's, I'd like to say it spans for 7 half generations, because it's still going on. I had my daughter home for a summer. She studies in China. And she was trying to pick my brain, and I wasn't getting along with her. And so I sent her down to Vincent. And they had this rapid romance for who knows, a year and a half of letters, and it got her off my back, and it made him happy as hell. Young 35-year good-looking girl with a head on her shoulders. I mean, it was a win-win. When Butterick kind of put Vincent on the map a little bit by putting him in Who's Who in American Poetry and hooking him up with the University of Connecticut, and when George was dying of cancer, we all chipped in and cooperatively published his collected poetry. And he passed away, and all of us who had taken part in it were asked to come to the memorial. And, of course, we come to the memorial, and I see Vinny, and he sees me, and he's... Well, they hadn't asked him to be on the venue. And he had come with a poem to read to George. So, make a long story short, all the usual suspects got done, and Vincent went up and read his poem to George. So when his contract with the University of Connecticut ran out, he came to me. I'd had Igneous up and going for quite a while. And to me, I gave him a full pass. Do whatever you want to do. You got my Aegis, I got ISBNs. You want me to edit, I'll edit. If you don't want me to edit, I won't edit. You're the only person who gets this pass with me. And so we began a series of four or five books. Some are, what did I do with them? Okay, first one was Tale of Psyche, which has been brought up here. And I'm going to just quickly, the epigram, after, we will be more real than we are now, way of the universe. Maker and crown, joy, maker and crown of all estates, as any forest knows. And I love minimalist poetry. I think, I often say I'm chief of police of the syllable police. But the more you can get done with the less always tickles me pink. So we started off with this, which was an old book that he kind of tweaked and did so forth. And there's two stories that go along with this. I had just reviewed, I'm not sure if it was Hermit in the Cloud or whatever, and it was a very good review, and he was tickled pink. But at the end of it, I said, you know, these poems could have taken place in the psyche of the poet, not just Gloucester. And he was furious at me. Totally furious at me for saying that, because it's Polis deal, right? So the next book that comes out is called A Tale of Psyche. We're all set to go to press. I said, well, send me down. I've proofed the book, but let me look at the cover. Trust me, I'm the lone wolf. I said, okay, lone wolf, off you go. And so he goes to Celicom and gives Ed Harrison the book, and it comes back, and sure enough, he typoed himself on the back cover. Perfect, isn't it? So I'm going to read a little bit from some of the books that we worked together doing. This is the Magi image. Who are the Magi? The Magi are the three wise men that come from Persia. They have the star script that are following Zoroaster, their master, through the sky, and arrive at the manger. Okay. My muse, because today I have been given life and the unexpectedness of all I sense overwhelms me with its bounty, so the flood of it is over, under, and upon me because I know her. Because she is more, who is more, deeply herself and myself, and quickens my imagination. Unlike anything alive, because she touches my mind with her own, and the substance is the same. The intoxication of another, like as far back as future, is actually this oneness, present, ah, the holding and beholding. Today is a singular plurality of herself, and all to come of her is in me. We are sun rain. Then, Garrett's not here, huh? Where is he? All right, he gets, there you go. Vincent and I were, for years, probably the first time I ever got up on a big stage was when he was reading with Ferlinghetti at Arlington Street Church. And he would, whenever Lawrence, Larry, Fazzanguli, that's what Vincent and I called him, came to town, he insisted on reading with Ferini. And he'd always read a Cape Ann poem. And the poem is a terrible poem. It kind of goes, and Olson and Creeley and Ferini never got it. It'd be like me going to San Francisco and writing a poem about the Coet Tower. It'd just be ridiculous. And he'd get up there and preen like an Episcopal minister with a scarf and read Cape Ann poem. So whenever Vinny and I got together, he'd say, "What's that guy doing? He's up there slapping you in the face and smiling at you." So Vincent called me up. You know, they each did like 45 minutes. After Vincent did a half hour, he stopped and called me up to the Arlington Street Church to read for 15 minutes, for probably the first time ever in front of that many people. So in the latter years, when I come down to take him to lunch, we talked about, let's just read the poem. Plotting Ferlinghetti's assassination. Now, maybe it should have been plotting Fazzanguli's assassination for Vincent Ferrini. At a table in downtown Gloucester over a fish sandwich, after walking past Garrett, unnoticed, using spoon, fork, and knife, the old man makes a tripod out of utensils, a metaphor for Larry. He knocks one leg out of the tripod, and all the utensils fall flat. It's that easy, Pita. He tells me, as we are evidently in cahoots in this mythical endeavor. It sets in a while, and then he smiles, and we agree to let him live. I'm trying to be time conscious. Am I doing okay? Teeny bit more. All right. And we're going to end with a little bit of Magi Image. Or no, with the Indweller. What's the Indweller? The Indweller, well, I mean, I could take you back to the diaspora from Atlantis through the Tibetan Sun Oracle right up through the mystery of Golgotha. Let's just say, let's put it this way. The Grail legend would tell you that the true nature of the Second Coming is when we individually, as a group, are able to let the Logos dwell within us. So, which in turn is, where is the Grail Cup? It's your own damn soul. You know, you open it up, it fills up, and then all of a sudden, it overflows with primal colors concentrated into jewels. Okay, I'm going for the short ones. On stage, Georgia O'Keeffe beside her two white balls, glaring down at a nine-year-old girl's drawing of two flowers in spontaneous orgasms. And then the ego eggs, the opium, the accumulation of neuroses, and the culture's miasma is the fog that keeps the eyeballs in its dragnet and the golden mist in the dewdrops. And I'm going to end with the dedication. This is what how he signed this book in the year 2000. Dear Peter, who has all, A-L-L, ways been where it is for people. Much love, Vincent. Okay, so what I see quickly in terms of what she was saying, Kay was saying about center and circumference being one, that was the early Vincent. The elder Vincent became a mystical, not a mystic, who understood there was the center, the circumference, and the radius to connect the two, i.e. the Shi in Chinese mythology or the Holy Ghost in Christianity or whatever. So I see Vincent, as he went through to the end of his life, having gone from being a mystic to a mystical. And the last visits I would have with him, I'd pick him up and he'd go, Peter, I got one foot in each world. And then a 26-year-old girl would walk by and he'd go, thank you very much.
Staying and for being such a wonderful audience and participation. I can feel your participation and I want us to have discussion and talk, but we do want to hear from Fred Whitehead. Just before I introduce Fred Whitehead and a special guest, I wanted to mention the whole song and show it to you. This is the book that was edited by Ken Warren and Fred Whitehead, who is the final speaker of this panel. Published by University of Illinois Press. And is this off? I just want to tell you, this book was never reviewed. And I just learned about that today from Fred. And if a book is not reviewed, how are we going to know about it? The book was never reviewed. It can still be reviewed. It's not too late. And there are two selected books of Vincent's that are terrific. The first one is a fabulous book called Selected Poems, and it's almost out of print. So that's another thing I want us to all be conscious of with everything else that's going on here. I want to introduce Fred Whitehead, but just before, we are honored to have here Truman Nelson's son, Garrison Nelson, and I think he's going to tell us about, are you going to tell us about the turn of events for the Writers' Center for a moment? And then right after that, we'll hear from Fred Whitehead all the way here from Kansas. So Truman Nelson's son, Garrison Nelson. Yay.
Well, you don't know me, but if you've read No Smoke, you've been introduced to my mother, Bertha Bronson, and to my father, Tanny Bronson, two of the most powerful poems in No Smoke. I knew Vincent, you know, all of my life. My father and Vincent, you know, both growing up in Lynn, as did I. And the unique competition that Vincent and my father had, which was one side of it. I must admit, I liked Vincent a lot more than I liked my father. Vincent was a lot nicer to me. In any case, when my father was dying, and I talked about Vincent, and he said, that fucking Vincent, he is the body of a peasant. He'll live forever. Well, he outlived Dad by 18 years, and I can see from this gathering, he does live forever. Thank you. As a gift to the Gloucester Writers' Center, my father's last book, The Old Man, which is about John Brown at Harper's Ferry, was recently republished by Haymarket Books in Chicago. And not a lot of money, but nevertheless, I've been able to get $973 in royalties, and I'm going to donate it today to the Writers' Center. Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I've been to a lot of events like this, and when I see the screen come down and the slides come up, my heart sinks. Because we've all been subject to the interminable displays of such things. This is a mere 12 pictures. So we're not, and I'm the last speaker, and so the end is at hand. yes, I'm from Kansas City, and I'm a little unused to such intoxicating experiences as this, with all of the art and the poetry and the talk and the literature. I'm always reminded of, someone mentioned Edward Dahlberg earlier, and Edward Dahlberg wrote a book on a biography called Because I Was Flesh, about growing up in Kansas City. And he said he would have stayed there if there had been two people he could have talked about books with. So it's changed a little bit. Maybe there are five or six now. But in any event, I want to say a little bit about how I realized Vincent was very much related to Gloucester and the place, but he has a reputation that extended far beyond Gloucester and far beyond Massachusetts. In Kansas City in the 1970s and 80s, we had an organization called the Fool Killer, the name of which I will not try to explain. But it lasted for 20 years, and in the mid-70s, we had a newspaper called The Fool Killer, and Jack Conroy, whom I'll mention more about in a moment, wrote a review of University of Connecticut's selected poems of Vincent Farini, which is literally how I first heard that he existed. And so in the mid-70s, there was a decision, the origin of which is disputed yet, to remember the legendary American Writers Congresses of the 1930s, the first one in 1935. And so we were heedless and ambitious and energetic, and we decided to repeat these things. I mean, sort of out of the... No one told us we couldn't do it. And most of us were on the edges of academia in any case. So we decided to have these cultural conferences, which did take place in 1978, 79, and 80, and again in 1985. And there are two or three veterans of those experiences are here with us today. Merritt Ellisour, and Jack Conroy were both at the 1935 Congress, so they came to Kansas City along with some other people, and we were off and running. So I just want to show you a little bit about, just because you may not have ever seen a picture of Merritt Ellisour or Jack Conroy and know who they were, so that's what I'm going to show you. Could we cut the light up here? What's that? Well, that's what I'm going to explain. But you'll get a much better image just for these few pictures. That's great. That's good. This is the building at 39th and Main, which has the Fool Killer, where we had the conferences. And it was actually owned by a man who became the ambassador to Britain under Ronald Reagan, the name of whom I've forgotten at the moment. It was a candy factory, then a bank, and so that was the building where they had the conferences. This is Merritt Ellisour, who was born in 1900 in Murray, Iowa, and her mother was a famous Midwestern socialist and later communist. And Merritt was blacklisted in the 1950s. I'm not going to say a whole lot about her career. You can look her up on the internet or in the library. But she came to the conference, and we all met her for the first time. Okay, next one. This is Jack Conroy, who wrote a novel called The Disinherited that was published in 1933. It's widely regarded as a classic of the American Depression literature and is still in print. So, and Conroy was at the 35 Congress, so he showed up. This is Meridell with Ernie Brill, who happens to be in attendance here, right here. I haven't seen him for 30 years, so. Yeah, Tekla, who was an artist, came from New York City. And so people came. We had no grants, and which was great, because we just came because we wanted to come and not because we were going to get tenure or anything like that. And this is Vincent with a poet named Joy Harjo, who some of you know about. She's still around. She's gotten interested in music in recent years as well as literature. Vincent is shown here explaining to Joy the important necessity of seeing through the eye of the navel. And I'm sure you've heard that they're both fully clothed, there's nothing terrible going on, but it's quite intense, yeah. And this is Vincent with Jack Conroy. Jack Conroy actually published Vincent in his magazine, The New Anvil, in 1940 or thereabouts. Okay. This is Vincent with Meridell. They had never met. Vincent had never been to that part of the country, unless, I mean, particularly to be participating in something like this, and he called it the Breadland. And so he was always coming up with new names for people and places. And so his name for Meridell was Merrydale. They were just like ancient friends immediately. Okay. And this is another, you know, somebody was pointing out this gesture. You know, they had to point that finger like that. 1980. And then I think one last picture. One more besides this. That's the last one. And so anyway, these, and that's all. For the pictures. These conferences were, we thought they were going to commence a new American Renaissance. And we were the bearers of this. We were going to see it through. It didn't happen that way. But for those of us who were there, it was formative in the most fundamental sense. The reason why I'd read about, as I mentioned, Vincent's existence and his selected poetry, but Truman Nelson came to Kansas City in 1979, and he said there's somebody else you ought to have out here, Vincent, for reading. And in his letter he said he's battle-scarred but still fighting. So he came out at that time. I want to mention a book that's still in print, The Truman Nelson Reader from the University of Massachusetts Press, which Garrison helped put together and see into print. It actually appeared after Truman's death, but he did get a chance to, the opportunity to see, I believe, the galley proofs before he died. Truman is a name to conjure with. We really ought to have a conference about Truman Nelson like this. I don't know if what's going on. He lived in Newburyport. But someplace here in Lynn or Gloucester or Newburyport, there ought to be some kind of gathering to discuss more about his life and his works. There's much more to Olson, and I think Ken really, and continues to do so in his really marvelous magazine called House Organ. Well, I just want to conclude with a couple of remarks. Hermit of the Clouds, I think, needs to be reprinted. It's something that should be taught in the schools here. I'm glad there's been some mention of, you know, Vincent visiting the schools and so on. But one of the tragedies of American literature at the present time is that these books may actually be in print, or some of their work might be in print, but it's not taught in the schools and it's not taught in the colleges anywhere. So Hermit of the Clouds needs to be reprinted. The whole song, which is the University of Illinois Press, even surely they could get some group of people in the English programs in the schools to teach these books. Or at least as electives, or the kids that are really interested in literature should know their own greatest local writers. Finally, a prediction on my part, since Vincent made so many predictions that proved to be accurate, in particular the depletion of the fisheries, the devastation of the environment, and all these things. I mean, he was way ahead of it in saying this was going to happen. I predict that someday Vincent's work will be in the Library of America, which is that great classic series that's reprinted all over. They even reprinted Philip Roth, which is incomprehensible to me. In any event, one of these days we'll see Vincent's poetry and his plays in the Library of America. Thank you very much for coming.
The old man. My son, who works in television, works at ABC News, contacted me about a year ago, and he said, "Dad, have you ever heard of Michael Wilson?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, I was looking for your father on the internet, and there in Wikipedia is a letter from Michael Wilson to your father about the old man, about the John Brown at Harper's Ferry." And he said, Michael Wilson wanted to make a screenplay about, based on the old man. And I said, gee, I wonder if that ever happened. In any case, so we talked about that. Well, it turned out Michael Wilson was a blacklisted screenwriter. Michael Wilson wrote the screenplay for Bridge on the River Kwai, Planet of the Apes, Sandpiper, It's a Wonderful Life, and Lawrence of Arabia. This was a true talent, but he was blacklisted, so consequently his name could never appear on the screen. They gave him Oscars, of course. He was dead at that particular point. They gave him posthumous Oscars. And so I was tracking this down, and sure enough, there is a screenplay. I have the screenplay. I have it with me, as a matter of fact. It's called The Raid on Harper's Ferry. And Michael Wilson was trying to get Robert Wise, who did The Sound of Music, to put it on. Wise was very excited about it, but Michael passed away. Michael's daughters are still alive, both in California, and I speak with them occasionally. But that's one of the reasons I wanted to come down here and talk to people who might give me some leads in terms of getting the screenplay made. So, yes, there is a screenplay. I have another screenplay that Truman wrote called Guns, which is about the IRA. Is Truman and his love of revolutionaries. Once again, that's one reason I wanted to come here to this particular event, also to celebrate Vincent, who I loved and adjoyed. When my mother passed away, Vincent, of course, had a horrible crush on my mother. And if any of you have read Hermit of the Clouds, you know there's a full paragraph of Vincent lusting after my mother. Truman's, actress wife. I must admit, I nearly, collapsed when I saw it in print. But that was Vincent. And in any case, but we all knew that about Vincent. I remember, I would bring, when I come up here to Gloucester, I'd bring a date along with me. Of course, Vincent would, grab quickly. I told people, I said, yeah, Vincent was still chasing women. I said, he remembered how, but he'd forgotten why. So in any case, but as I say, I have those here. I brought with me, I have 23 copies of Vincent's books, and I brought a dozen with me, and I'm willing to sort of auction them off or whatever. As a matter of fact, a sort of an original of No Smoke that I brought with me. That really is my father's copy. My mother's copy, I wrote all over it. I identified all the various people that mom told me were in the book. So I'm absolutely ecstatic about being here and you know, sharing in this rather remarkable gathering. And, of course, in Elaine Wing's rather vibrant painting. She did one of my father as well, which I'm not sure where that is. Is that right? Oh, okay. Well, in any case, this is I'm delighted to be able to contribute what I can to the Gloucester Writers Center and wish you continued and sustained success.
We're very happy to be here.